the hell? Wow.
Sorry. I didn't expect that to be that funny.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Nomad Podcast. My name is Mitch Maxine. As always, if you have any comments or questions, put them up on my personal Facebook page, the Nomad Podcast Facebook page, or send me an email at nomadpodcast2021@gmail.com. We're light a couple of panel members. Jason's gone back to Japan, and Rick's got COVID. So it's just Bob, Lenny, Darren, and myself. Lenny, how you doing, brother?
Good, good. Good to be back. Hoping that between the four of us, we have enough to talk about. Well, I don't think that's going to be an issue, going on previous performances.
Considering it was just the four of us for about 6 months, I think we'll be fine.
So, yeah, good to be back. Looking forward to this one.
Darren, after some technical difficulties, how you doing, man?
That's great, yeah. I think the only difference between six people and four people is that we get to talk more. So you get the other inputs of other people, but you have to hold back and let everybody else finish. So it's easier when you only have to let four people finish as opposed to six. But yeah, it's good to be here.
Okay, Bob, how are you?
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that I'm a racist piece of crap that shouldn't be allowed on this podcast. But anyway, I'm doing great. I hope everybody's happy and healthy, and it's good to be back, and can't wait to dive into the topics today.
Okay, folks, tonight's talking points come primarily from a listener who wrote in. Let me just get his name. I wanted to give him a shout-out. His name is Kenneth Wickman, and Kenny wrote me about 2 weeks ago, I guess. Actually, closer to a week ago, with a bunch of talking points, so... Ken, thanks so much for sending those in. We're going to get to those absolutely. I sent out the talking points a few days back, and Lenny wrote back with one that I really, really want to get into because I'm hoping we'll get through this one talking point because there's a lot to unpack in it, and it feeds into something I've wanted to talk about pretty enthusiastically, but never have gotten a chance to. So let's start with, before we get to the talking points, God damn it, I keep forgetting. Without asking you all individually, does anybody have anything you want to say about the podcast, about the talking points, anything before we get going?
I just want to reiterate the congratulations on the 1 year anniversary. That's all.
It's here, it's here. Cool. Yep.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. Thank you. I appreciate that. And you guys should take as much, I don't know what the word is, joy, pride,
credit,
because me just sitting here talking like an idiot every week would be pretty damn boring. So I appreciate you guys coming on. Len, Darren, anything you want to add before we get started?
Yeah, I'd like to say it's interesting to be talking because we've always invited people on or invited people to email you with topics or ideas or questions or concerns or whatever. So this was one of the few times where someone actually wrote in and has topics that we get to discuss. So I find that interesting in itself and kind of look forward to that continuing on in the future as well.
It's just nice to know that both of your listeners out there are writing in with emails.
Actually, there are three, son of a bitch. So all three of the listeners wrote in with questions.
I stand corrected.
And I hope I haven't railroaded the listeners' questions by throwing an extra one on top of it. So I do apologize.
Me too. So, but the problem is, Len, your question is, it's got a lot, there's a lot to unpack in that question, so we'll see how it plays out.
Okay.
Okay, so let's get going. I'm just going to read this as it's written. What are your thoughts when a student, adult or child, has been training for however many years, and you as their instructor come to the realization that this student has gone as far as they're going to go, that for whatever reason, you realize this just isn't for them? How do you address that? There's a lot to talk about there. Who wants to go? Len, why don't you go first since it was your question?
I want to see what you guys had to say.
Okay.
Well, let's clarify the issue just a bit before
Lenny. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right, they've gone as far as they're going to go. You mean they're losing motivation? They don't have the innate ability to get better than they are? How exactly would you phrase that?
The way it reared its head particularly was there was a situation arose in the last couple of weeks where someone has gotten as far as their first brown belt. motivation is an issue because they're there a long time and they're kind of thinking, well, time-wise, I deserve to go for my black belt now. But skill set-wise and effort-wise and ability-wise, they're not there. And the bar has to be raised for them to get there. And we all, you know, me in good conscience cannot stand around and say, okay, you're here, whatever amount of years, you deserve your black belt. I just won't do that because... I won't. Now it's got to a situation where it's a bit of a double-edged sword because they don't see progression, so interest is losing. And as the interest is waning, they're regressing in ability and motivation. So they're almost at a stage where, do you know what, you're not even at the standard of the belt you're wearing. Which then that got into the whole rank structure thing, which we've kicked around plenty of times. And then I have that then coupled then with a guy who isn't particularly interested in how far he goes belt-wise, but his flexibility and mobility as time has gone by has got really, really poor, and he came to the realization that I can't really do this anymore. So he stepped back from classes, even though he was loving them, and he only comes to my Thursday night sessions now because he just said, I can't go any further on Monday nights. So I'm looking at going, here's a guy who isn't really pushed with the belt, but is beating himself up because he can't progress, and I've got someone who is obsessed with the belt and isn't pushing themselves because they're not interested anymore.
Okay, so Len, you've laid out a couple of scenarios there, so let's choose one of them at a time and talk about those. And I think the one that's going to spark the most conversation is your first scenario. You've got a student who has gone as far potentially as they're able to go, and they want to go further. The brown belt who feels that he's been there long enough that he deserves a shot at his black belt. Just in that, there's a bunch of questions, and we glossed over one, and I'd kind of like to get everybody's input. Do you think that time, amount of time training, should factor into a decision to promote somebody when their ability isn't up to snuff?
That sounds pretty cut and dry to me.
It does, but there are so many clubs out there who will do that. Oh, this guy's been around for 8 years. God, he's got to get his black belt. Like, it's cut and dry to me, too. Like, to me, it's insane. But, Darren, what do you think?
I'd still like to narrow it down and get a little bit more specific on the thing, because my first thought was, like, who cares? Just let the person train, and that's it. But I think Lenny was saying that the motivation doesn't seem to be there. The person's not putting in the effort. There's a difference between reaching your potential physically and wanting to, say, go for your black belt grading, but you've reached your potential. There's another thing where you're not even putting in the effort. So if he's actually not putting in the effort, then it's a no-brainer. If he's actually really busting his ass, but he just can't get any better, then that's something you kind of address on a whole different wavelength, if you know what I mean. Like, he is trying. So it sounds to me like this guy isn't trying. So that's kind of where I'm teetering there.
Let's talk in broad terms instead of about a person or an individual. To me, I don't care how hard you're trying. If you're not able to do the thing that you're supposed to be able to do in order to get your next rank, it doesn't matter how hard you're trying. You can't do it.
That's weird, man, because if you're trying hard, don't you automatically get better?
No, you don't. In an ideal world, you do. But the reality of it is people have different potential levels. And for some people, it doesn't matter how hard you try. You're only going to go so far.
That's the case in point of the second case I raised. The guy busts his ass every week, but he just knows himself, I can't go any further with this.
But then why are you trying to go further? Like, if you just enjoy attending classes,
exactly what I said to him.
And that's the easy one. That's why I wanted to talk about the other one, because this one's the easy one. If he enjoys training, understands his own limitations, and adjusts his training schedule accordingly, there really isn't a problem. He's doing what he wants to do to the degree that he feels he can do it. That sounds like a reasonable resolution to me. Am I missing something?
No. Yeah, I agree with that.
What if somebody who's 50 years old joins the club? What limitations do they face right at the outset? I mean, they're never going to get very far, however hard they try. But of course, they're welcome to try as hard as they can. How does that fit into this scenario? I kind of lost track.
Well, the one student Lenny was talking about, and Lenny, maybe you should, I don't want to speak for you, maybe you can lay out the circumstance of that first scenario again.
They joined me quite young, and they joined me as a kid, and they're now a young adult, late teens. Ability-wise, I know if they put their minds to it, could achieve it, but it's a combination of, I suppose, the age that they are, a little bit of ego, and expectation of, I'm here so long, why the hell haven't I been promoted? With an apathy then, because there's a bit of a mood going on because they haven't
been up. God damn it.
And I initially, and what's compounded even more was after you come back from COVID, like I set a goal, it's okay, if things go to plan, we could start looking at whatever date it was towards having a look and see where we are. And then that date came and there was no progression, and I said, well, okay, we got to kick it down the road further. And now it's kind of, every time you try and, you know, you set a date, you keep moving it, and what the hell's going on? And I should have it this stage. I mean, it's not fair. This kind of,
so. Is it becoming personal on his part? He kind of resents what's going on?
I'm not sure.
Can you not just explain it to him and say, look, dude, you're not ready. You're not up to scratch. Like, have a look at the people that are...
I have, yeah. And I wouldn't mind. They've sat in and seen the show down grade. They know what's involved.
Well, the other thing is let him go test for it and get the shit kicked out of him and fail.
I should also add that this is female, not male. I don't know if that changes anything.
Depends on her.
Good. Yeah. Len, how long has she been training?
About 8 years.
8 years. And started when she was, what, you said 9, I think?
Yeah, thereabouts, yeah, I think.
Wait a sec. Carry the 3. 20. She's 20. Got it.
She's 37. Got it. Okay.
She's dead.
The thing is, it's funny when we talk about it amongst ourselves, it sounds like a pretty straightforward circumstance. Like Darren said, you sit down with her, you say, look, I'm sorry, you're just not up to speed. If you want, I can give you an itemized list of things you need to work on, and here's the direction you need to go in order to get
ready. I've done all that.
I'm at a bit of a loss to understand what her issue is. If it's been laid out to her what she needs to do, that she's just not there yet. If you want to get there, here's what you need to do. I know it's more complicated than just what we're talking about, but that's what I'm trying to get at.
And it sounds like you've gone as far as you can go.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say when in the question and the talking points is, you know, the realization the student is gone as far as they're going to go.
And you have too. It sounds like you have too in reaching out and trying.
What really messed things up then was there's another 2 students who would have started probably after them. Who have really worked hard and worked hard. These guys are due a showdown grade at Christmas. And they're going, they're going ahead of me.
This is one of the eternal contradictions of the marketing of karate, at least to my experience. People always say, or you always hear, progress at your own rate. It doesn't matter how well you're doing compared to other people, but it absolutely does for exactly that reason.
But it shouldn't. Right.
But it does. Whether it should or shouldn't, I don't know that it's possible for an average person who's been training for 8 years to see someone who's been training for 3 or 4 pass them in rank and move, especially when you're moving to a black belt rank. That's hard to say.
And again, in an ideal world, that would be motivation.
So, Lenny, are you saying the student has reached their physical potential? They're not able to do better?
Well, potential-wise, they've probably reached where they are, but when it comes to aggression and motivation and enthusiasm for actually getting out there and doing it, no, it's just total apathy and almost eyes rolling. Oh, here we go.
Did they start out with more promise than they show now, like more motivation?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That goes without saying, I suppose. Sorry, dumb question.
Anybody on the panel here, did anyone feel overconfident going into a grading? Did anybody actually look forward to a grading and feel like they were getting passed over and they're demanding, like, I want to take that grading? I was scared shit, Darren. At every grading. Like, if someone said, look, you don't have to ever grade, I'd be like, Grant, I'll just keep plugging away.
Me too. The thing is, we've talked about perspectives on gradings in the past. My perspective after orange green was whatever. And I never looked at it as a competitive thing. I don't care what rank you are. I just love training. I just love the working out.
If I'm passed over for a grading, it's what's wrong with me, not what's wrong with them.
That's an important point, I think. If you're, and anyone correct me if I'm wrong, I think we all share that perspective that if I don't get promoted or if we didn't get promoted or whatever, we automatically turn that internally and go, what am I not doing right? What do I need to do better to get what I'm looking for, to move forward? Someone who goes, I'm not moving forward. What's wrong with the structure? What's wrong with the infrastructure that I'm studying in? I think that's a different perspective.
And this might be a symptom of society as a whole these days, the way it's trending, is that people turn the blame outward, like in a very large way. Like,
yeah, don't get me started.
Well, I'm going to open a huge door on this one, so.
Okay, go ahead.
But this is also being driven by a parent who feels that they're here so long and now they're a young adult. Why the hell aren't they going? And there's also interference coming there.
Yeah, I have no patience.
This is why I don't teach anymore.
If you bring your child to my... Okay, calm down, Mitch. Take a breath.
I knew this was going to happen.
See, if I'm running a club and you bring your child to my dojo, you put your child's martial arts education in my hands. I will do what I'm supposed to do as objectively and fairly and with your student and your child's best interests at heart. If you don't like how I'm doing it, there's the door. Take your student to another club, whatever.
Now, let's be cautious when we say something like that. They can't just take you at your word. As a parent, you can't just listen to a teacher say, I have your student's best interests at heart. And
you're right.
Expect you to...
Thank you, Bob. That was actually a good level check. I appreciate that. If a parent came to me and said, look, what's going on? I wouldn't go, well, I'm the instructor and you just have to listen to me and get the fuck out if you don't like it. That's not how I would approach it. I would sit down with that parent and say, okay, look, here's the situation. Here's the expectation. Here's the way your child is performing. And it's not up to the expectation of the rank to which they aspire. Here's what we need to do to get them there. Let's work as a team. Let's not be adversarial about it. Let's, you as the parent and I as the instructor, let's work together to understand what your child needs to do to move forward. Lenny, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like that's how you kind of run things, is it not?
Yeah. This has been done, but yet still.
But the thing is, I have a saying that I quite like, and it's, all you can do is all you can do. And once you've done all that you can do, there's nothing left to be done. You just do what you can do in the direction you think it should be done. And if you still can't find some traction with these people or some understanding, I'm not sure there's much more to do but part.
And I'm almost convinced in my head that if eventually you get there and they do this great, they're gone. They're going to leave anyway.
Yeah, it's unfortunate and it's sad, but there are times when you just can't do anymore.
Exactly.
Yes, I agree with everybody. I don't have anything more to add. That's pretty much it, I think. Like, it'd be different. Like, we can say, okay, have you tried this? Have you tried that? But it does sound like Lenny's tried everything, and just as Mitch put it, once you've tried everything, there's nothing more you can do. You're just going to have to let it go. Or you can take that one last step and let them take the test, and if they fail the test, it's either an eye-opener or they walk away. But you've given them the opportunity.
A test could be such an eye-opener in that regard. Like, I've been lucky enough not to have failed a test, but if you fail a test, man, wouldn't that be a soul-searching moment?
I'm going to step in just for a second in an unrelated way and say I take exception to your phrasing that you were lucky enough not to have failed a test.
Okay, yeah, well.
No, this is an important point. We all tend to be self-deprecating, and I empathize with that and I appreciate it because I'm the same way. But let's understand that when you've earned something, I don't think there's any shame in saying, I earned this.
I think what he was saying was just he didn't have to suffer from failing a test to experience what it felt like.
I'm probably going to edit that whole bit I just set out because it's irrelevant. But I wanna dig into this a little deeper. I think we've solved Lenny's problem for him.
Well, I got you. But here's
you're
here's
welcome, Lenny.
Oh no, there's a second.
Anytime.
No, there's
anytime.
More. There's,
make your checks.
There's more. Okay, well let's just put that one case aside, and you come to a second case, and this would be not necessarily for children, but for adults as well. And they come in, the person just. It's like someone who wants to be a hockey player, I suppose, and they just have no balance on skates, and they can't do this, they can't do that. and somebody comes in and they want to train and it's just not working. They can't kick properly, they've no coordination, they've no balance, left and right is mixed up, they can't do a kata, they can't spar. At what stage do you sit down and say, look man, you're throwing money for at something, or you're doing something that, okay, fair enough, if you're just doing it for the enjoyment of it, that's grand.
Right.
But if you're here, but if you're here to, you have full in the back of your mind that someday I'm going to get a black belt, at what stage do you sit them down and go, look man, I don't think this is going to happen? And how do you address that one?
Do you ever say that? Do you ever say that to a student?
No, absolutely not, because everyone will improve at a different rate. Some people just really, really struggle. And when people that struggle and they're enjoying it and doing their best, but a lot of this has stemmed back from, and Mitch said it just before we started the broadcast, that, you know, I came out with a massive kind of epiphany in the last few weeks, having traveled to Thailand and witnessed different styles and the way things are run. It has me rethinking everything about the system I train in. It's kind of one of the things I'm kicking around in my head, that you get people who come in and they just think, okay, next belt, but when do you grind to a halt and say, look, you're just not getting there? Or do you say it to them? Or do you promote them? Or do you
not, God, no.
Oh, God, no.
Dear God.
And that, no, and that's, see, that's not... You see, that's, that I wouldn't entertain that, you know, by any means.
That's the part of this question I really wanted to kind of drill down to, because I've seen so many circumstances where clubs promote people who are not ready for rank based on little else other than the amount of time that they've invested in the club.
And that's the start of the fall of everything.
Exactly. It's the beginning of the end. When you start, I've said it before, I'll say it again, as soon as you promote anybody for any reason other than their ability, you enter that slippery slope into, you know, promoting people who are not worthy of the rank. And I understand the notion. Okay, let me throw this out here as a question rather than imperative. We've all talked in the past about, should we base rank on comparative ability or individual progress?
Yeah.
When you get somebody who has gone as far as they can go in terms of their individual potential, there is an argument, I don't agree with this argument, but there's an argument to be made that if you promote people based on their individual ability, once someone has peaked relative to their individual ability, shouldn't they get a black belt?
Now, wait a second. This is an exact analog to somebody going to music school and learning how to play the piano. And they're gone as far as they can go, and they just can't play the piece that is necessary to play competently to pass the certification for that thing. Fuck it. They just can't do it. They don't get the certificate. And that's as far as it goes, and God bless them, and that's it.
Yeah, you don't give a pilot who can take off and fly a plane but can't land it.
Exactly.
The full license.
Yeah, and nobody, yeah, the okay, thing is, but that's a great point. That's a great point, Lenny, because piloting an aircraft involves people's lives, and that's why the standards are so freaking high on it. So people assume that if people aren't going to die if I don't do it right, the standards can be, you know, just thrown out the frickin' window, and that makes me angry.
I sympathize and empathize with where you're coming from, Bob, and I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second. Please don't think I agree with what I'm about to say. I'm just putting it out there for fodder for discussion. In karate, we're not talking about life and death. We're not talking about someone's ability to land a plane with 5 passengers, and if they can't do it properly, people could die. Here we're talking about what I'm going to guess 95% of the people who are involved in martial arts do it as a part-time thing. It's what I do on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It gets me out of the house, blah, blah, blah.
Man, you're really riling me up. Go ahead.
This is why I'm being that's what the devil's advocate does. Is that a reasonable argument? That people who take the martial arts as a part-time hobby, should those people still be in the running to get a black belt, even
you
if
son of a bitch. What a son of a bitch this guy is.
Okay, Bob, go.
No.
Okay, when you were coming up through the ranks at Jushin, how many days a week did you train?
Oh man, I don't remember. I guess 3.
How many hours a day of those 3 days did you train?
2.
So you trained for 6 hours a week. There are some people who train in such a way that they would look at someone who trains 6 hours a week and go, that's not commitment. That's absolutely a joke.
Yep.
So do you still feel justified in getting your rank? Do you feel you deserved your blank belt when you got it?
Oh, at the time? Sure.
Now?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So there are people who train, and I'm not exaggerating, 40 and 50 hours a week, who would look at someone who only trains six and say, that person's not worthy.
Absolutely. Now,
you are one of the people who, and we all are, well, I don't know about anyone else. Bob and I, certainly. Bob, because he admitted it, and I, because I'm agreeing with it. When I was coming up through the ranks, I only trained six, maybe 7 hours a week. Do we have standing to look at someone who only trains 2 hours a week and say, oh, you're not, you'll never be ready because you only train 2 hours a week?
That's a simple matter of, this is what I have to offer as a teacher, and this is what I do, and this is our schedule, and if you adhere to it and meet the standards of black belt, then we give you a black belt. That's all that is.
The part that I agree with that on is meeting the standards of a black belt. I don't care how many hours or minutes or days a week you train. What I care about is your ability. Does that training feed into the ability that is the base requirement for the ranks that you aspire to achieve? So it's a tough question. It's a tough question because, like I said, a lot of people, most of the people who train in the martial arts do it as a hobby. They do it as a, yeah, I'd like to do karate. That's kind of cool. I'd like to be able to kick like Bruce Lee. Oh, that's awesome. Just because they have that perspective, do they automatically get discounted as someone who is going to eventually perhaps get a black belt?
If I'm learning to play the piano and I can play a certain piece reasonably well, then I get a certain certification. And anybody who's trained twice as hard and can play brilliantly, way better than me, can look down with disdain and say, yeah, you're a junior. And I'll gladly look up and say, yes, I am. But I've got what I've got, and that's it.
Just as a curiosity, typically how long does it take to achieve Shodan in with Jushin?
Is that right,
roughly,
Mitch?
Yeah. Typically. Sure. Typically.
Yeah, somebody who's pretty devoted and works hard and, you know.
By devoted, how many hours a week are you talking here?
Six.
Training in the dojo, six.
So by comparison, typically to get a Shodan in my dojo takes anything between 9 and 11.
I just think Lenny's looking at us going, you guys
penis
suck.
Sizes.
No, God, no. that wasn't the reason for the point. I'm just saying it's very easy for us to say time served and so on, but when we're all coming from different time bases of how long it typically should take there, it's a very hard one to judge then.
It is. And again, it comes back to who cares how much time you've been training. What matters is, what ability have you attained? But the problem with that is, it's completely subjective. There's no objective way to determine how good someone's sidekick is. Or is there?
I think the eternal struggle is for head instructors to try to make it as objective as possible.
And you've also kind of answered a big of the initial point that we brought up about, I raised the case of this student who's pushing for a Shodan. And it boils down to the quality of their training. We're offering them the quality of it. They're just not taking up on that and offering the same quality of effort back. And that's when you really hit an impasse.
There are people... Look, Mark Bell tells a story of one of his brown belts whose wife came to him and dressed him down for her husband not being promoted. And I believe I remember a story of a guy just showing up to class wearing a black belt one day because he felt he'd been training long enough to deserve it. There are so many things that feed into whether someone deserves a black belt or not. And unfortunately, they are all subjective. And as soon as you have that level of subjectivity, it's chaos trying to figure out who deserves it and who doesn't.
But I'll say it again, the eternal struggle is trying to make it objective. Every instructor goes through this struggle to try to not make it subjective. Subjective is the enemy.
Agreed. And frankly, let's talk about a particular technique. When you're talking about a sidekick, every instructor knows the structure that a sidekick should have, where the chamber is, where the extension is, the foot position, the return chamber, the settle back down in the stance. So if you judge people exclusively on the objective requirement of a sidekick, but and this is the part that messes with my head, why are people being promoted who don't objectively meet the requirements of the rank to which they aspire?
Two analogies. The one, as Bob was saying about the piano thing, like if you go to piano lessons, they're only once a week. If you only play the piano during your lesson, you will never progress. So right. the teacher gives you the tools, and then you go home and you bust your ass on the piano so that when you go back the following week, you've improved and she can teach you the next lesson. And I think the same if you take, say, kata in karate. If you go up to two classes a week, you might not even do kata in one of those classes. So if you do kata in one of them, and you might do it three or four times in that night, are you going to win first place at a tournament based on that? No. You're going to have to go home and do it on your own over and over and over so that your kata is good enough to compete in a tournament. So again, it goes back to that. Just because you show up to two classes a week for 5 years, that's not going to cut it. You have to do your homework. You have to do other things. You have to put in outside time if you actually want to progress. That's just the nature of it. So then it goes back to, I tend to be soft and go on the individual and say, look, you're putting in the effort, so you're going to get graded. But again, after listening to everybody on these podcasts, I tend to lean toward just, it should be, look, you're not going to make it past blue belt. That's just the way it is. You don't have the capabilities. Don't worry about it. It's nothing against you. Be happy and enjoy yourself. Don't worry about trying for the next belt. Just be happy training and learning whatever you learn.
The problem is all of our clubs that traditional karate clubs, and I'm not talking about MMA because Darren said on a number of occasions that they don't have a belt ranking system. But let's talk about the clubs that do. It's easy to say to a student, oh, don't worry about what rank you are as long as you're progressing personally, blah, blah, blah. But the entire club structure is based on rank. You line up based on rank. You're put with different people based on rank. Everything about how the club is structured is based on rank. So
and you're kind of pushing into the force of the listener questions with this one as well, actually.
And we'll get there pretty soon because we're going to take a break in a minute and then we'll get to the listener questions.
Good.
But
it's just a good segue.
Exactly. But just to put a point on it, it's really hard to put out the perspective of don't worry about your rank when the entire club structure is based on rank. You go to a tournament, you're categorized based on your rank, not on how hard you try. Hey, the people who try really hard, right. You're in ring one. Like, that's not how it works. The entire structure of traditional karate is based on rank. So it kind of galls me when clubs try to pretend that, oh, it's all about personal progression. No, it's not, actually. If you line up based on rank, if you have gradings based on rank, if you structure your classes based on rank, you can't turn around and ask your students not to worry about rank.
Yeah.
You got to make sure that the brown belts in the front line don't embarrass themselves to the yellow belts in the back line. You got to have the standards.
Yeah, you're supposed to be learning from those in front of you.
Exactly, and that's another hard line to follow.
But I don't think there's ever a club that I've trained at that you didn't laugh at somebody in the front row.
Right.
compared to the other people that were in the front row.
God love
my club. They're just laughing at the instructor.
No, I agree with what Darren said. I've seen it before where students of lower rank look at students of higher rank going, what? Like, No. Like, and I've experienced that as well. Okay, anyway, guys, let's take a break. So let's pause.
Oh, geez, we'll
sounds good.
I know. But we're going to the... Kenny, don't worry. We're hitting your questions in the second half of the podcast. I swear to God. Okay, guys, let's take a break. We'll come back in a couple of minutes. Okay, folks, we're back from the break. So that was a really good talking point, Len. Thank you for bringing that up. It took almost an hour to get through it. So, and I don't even know if we actually arrived at any conclusions.
Late too, because the technical
true.
And all that, so.
Okay, so we're going to go to Ken's talking points. So let's start. I want to jump down to his second talking point. So here it is. How important are the things that many of us were weaned on as part of our training? And Len, I'm not sure if this applies to you, but it certainly does to Bob, Darren, and I, that were outside of the actual techniques that we learned. For instance, learning the names of the techniques in Japanese, or what passes for Japanese in North American karate schools. Let's start with that. Is there any point to that?
I kind of see it as we're doing the best we can in case one of us goes to Japan to actually take some classes. And that's kind of how I justify it to myself. It's a little pretentious. And especially when somebody's in a conversation in English and they go, yeah, I'm taking karate, and they try to put the accent in to make
karate.
It's a little much, but I can justify it in my own head by saying, look, I'm trying to pay homage to the origin of the friggin' thing. We're trying to actually follow a tradition as best we can in our stupid way over in North America to teach it. And yes, it's stilted and dumb the way we pronounce stuff, but yeah, again, we're doing the best we can.
But shouldn't
if somebody goes to Japan, they might not be too intimidated in class.
Sorry, Bob, if we're actually trying to pay homage to the Japanese perspective from which we draw our martial arts, is it not incumbent on us to at least make sure we're pronouncing things correctly?
Yeah, well, that's part of the thing. And actually, you know, presumably everybody considers actually trying to take some Japanese lessons in order to be better. No, I consider it.
Okay, so you, so when you say everybody, you mean you.
Well, I assume that everybody's the same as me, so yeah. You guys
Len,
are the same as me.
At your club, do you guys use Japanese terminology?
You see, this is one where we're kind of stuck in the middle, because Kenpo began in China originally, and it was the Yoshida clan brought it over then to Japan. The Komatsu clan took it over then, so it's kind of stuck in the middle. And when I was brought up through all the cue belts to Shodan, the only Japanese we had was Yame, and that was it. Nothing else. And it was only because I was started mixing with people from other styles, and people came and trained with me and so on, we kind of started taking on the Japanese influence of it. I mean, I even went and refereed in Kenpo tournaments with the new, what they call it, the American Kenpo, and they're calling Yame a center ref, and people looking at me going,
"Now,
hang on, what's he saying?
The point is, you use Asian terminology, right?
Okay,
which is
not
Japanese.
Yeah. Well, we do now. Predominantly anything that I would use now is Japanese. It's very limited what I have, but I would stick to Japanese, yeah.
Len, let me ask you something, because I'll answer this question for us before I put you on the spot.
Yeah.
I have it from people who live in Japan, speak Japanese. A lot of the terminology we use, we mispronounce, and we use it in the wrong context and blah, 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 blah. My question is, how much effort should be put into making sure that we're using the terminology and pronouncing the terminology correctly? For our part, the answer is zero. We take a very North American sort of, oh, that's how I think it's pronounced, so I'll just take a shot at it. We don't actually go out of our way to try and learn the proper usage and pronunciation. So in your club, do you guys do that? Do you make an effort to try and understand how it should be spoken and then speak it that way?
I suppose in a nutshell, no, because we reproduce what we were taught. And then again, I suppose if that teaching was incorrect, we're just going to carry it on, I suppose.
Right.
But I think Bob hit a nail on the head that many respects we're just paying homage to the traditions of it without actually going in depth into, are we getting this correct? Which I suppose in one sense could be classed as disrespectful.
I'm lucky in that I've been to a Japanese Aikido club, a Japanese Kendo club, where they actually spoke Japanese during the class. So in that sense, you know, I was glad I came to it with what little tiny microscopic bit of of understanding I had of the terminology, and that got me by. It was fine. And if I had gone there only speaking English, I would have been far more flummoxed and just confused. Mm.
Darren, what do you think?
With regards to the question itself as how important are the things, I don't think they're important at all, to be honest with you. But in saying that, like, to me, it's all about the training. So if I liked the club because of their training, if they spoke Japanese and they wanted me to learn the terminology, I'll just take that in stride and I'll learn it because that's where I want to train. If I don't like the club and I go to another club and they don't speak any Japanese whatsoever, but they do everything else traditional karate, but I like the training, then I'll train there and I don't care whether we learn Japanese or not.
Leave it to Darren to come up with the perfect perspective.
I don't think it's being disrespectful. I think if you're training somewhere and they make you learn it, then you learn it because that's where you're training. If they don't follow that doctrine, then it's not a disrespectful. You're just training. It's got nothing to do with the language and stuff. And the other thing too is like, nowadays, because even traditional karate is influenced by so many other arts and stuff. So, you know, really speaking Japanese, like as Lenny said, Kempo comes from China, and if you're adding judo or jiu-jitsu, that might come from other countries as opposed to Japan. And who's to say the whole lineage thing? I know the next question down is about history and stuff like that. And while I do find it interesting, is it really important to my day-to-day training? I just don't see it because there's so many arts out there that have a history. I don't think we need to just know the history of karate and that means anything.
I don't want to get ahead of the talking points because Darren's right. He's kind of touched on the next one. Just to put on my own perspective on the first one about the Japanese or Asian terminology, my perspective on that has always been the things that we do and the things that we ask our students to do are kind of head and shoulders above the average things that people are expected to do in their hobbies, and it requires a fair bit of discipline. And I think that everything that we can do to instill a sense of discipline in the students is only a good thing. So yeah, you know what, we're probably, and I'm not probably, we are definitely mispronouncing a lot of the terminology, using it in the wrong context. But at the end of the day, I don't think it matters much. I think we could apply mono and multiple syllabic grunts to each technique and just call that, like, here's Uchiuki. Oh, we'll call it that. I don't care what you call it. It doesn't matter whether you make a noise and that's an Uchiuki or inside middle block, or you use a bastardized term like Uchiuki and that's an inside middle block, as long as they are required to understand it as that sound, it adds a level to the discipline that they are expected to adhere to, and I think that's only a good thing. So when I hear people go, oh, we're trying to pay homage to the, you know, the origins of our art form, I kind of have to say, look, if you really wanted to pay homage to it, I can't help but think we should look into it a little more in terms of how it should be pronounced and how the context should be related through the language we use. But I've never looked at it that way. I've always looked at it as it's just another way to instill a sense of discipline on the students.
But you just made an argument, it seems to me, for not worrying about Japanese terminology or whatever.
Right, yeah. Right? Because to do it means to apply a level of discipline that the students have to adhere to. I think that's a good thing. To say this is an inside middle block, that's easy, that's English. To say an inside middle block is Uchiuki and you have to apply some discipline in your own brain, not only to understand that the words mean what they mean, but they also are associated with this particular movement, applies a certain level of discipline that I think is important for the students. I think.
Wow, never thought about it that way.
I think the terminology just adds a level of requirement that instills a sense of discipline that I think is really important for the students. So that's
never thought about it that way.
How I've always perceived that. Okay, let's go on to the second point, and Darren kind of touched on it. Again, Len, I can't speak for your club, but our club on the requirement sheets, it has some history of karate and who brought it to Canada and the lineage and all that stuff. And I never, coming up through the ranks, I'll be perfectly honest, I was never asked about it. I don't think I need to know the history to be able to do a front kick properly. History was never the thing that motivated me. I am interested in the immediate lineage of our style, but the history of karate, to the degree that it's defined on our requirement sheets, I couldn't care less about, and I couldn't think it's less important. So what do you guys think?
Yeah, I think if you're interested in that sort of thing, that's great. If you're not, then it's not important. I don't think it's a big deal to go either way. And I watch countless things just on YouTube. You get down that rabbit hole, and I do find it's interesting to see where the various styles came from. But do I think they should be part of the training? No. If that's something you want to go do in your own time and research that, all the power to you, that's what you're interested in. But I don't think it has anything to do with the training.
Okay, well, let me jump in. If you purport to teach a certain style, then presumably you have to be a little bit educated in the style. So yes. Let's talk about that for just for a second.
I agree.
We're supposed to teach Chitaru.
I don't even know what that is, to be honest with you.
Right, exactly. And who
does? A thousand ways.
But the thing is,
who knows?
It's the Chitosi guy, you know.
Exactly.
I know it's irrelevant to the training. If that's part of what your marketing is about, all right, let's put it that way. If that's what you promise to teach, then you have an obligation to look into it and to carry it on. And we got into this topic earlier in a different episode. You have some obligation to stick to their practices. If that's what you purport to teach, when somebody comes in and says, "I want to learn Chitoru karate," then you tell them, "That's what we teach."
Sorry, can I pause there for a second? Whoever walks into a dojo and says, "I want to learn Chitoru karate," or no, "I want to learn Shotokan karate."
Okay, they don't walk in saying that, but they walk in and the teacher says, "We teach that."
Okay, but that's a different issue. Who cares? Are you saying that because we propose or purport to teach Chitoru karate that there's an obligation to teach the history of Chitoru karate?
At least know of it.
Why?
Because you're not teaching it unless you know of it.
We're teaching the techniques that are associated with that style.
No. You're teaching the interpretation of them from your head instructor.
Absolutely,
who got it,
right.
Got them from his.
Right.
And who
so
knows
how is
where's what's lost in the translation?
Then I'd be afraid to learn the history to find out we're doing it wrong. Let's just keep doing what we're doing.
That's what for God's sake. Well, Bob, when you say the history, what do you mean? Do you mean the lineage?
No.
Well, like, what are you talking about?
What do you purport to teach? And if you're saying I teach my interpretation of this style, that's entirely different from saying I teach this style. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, but
If you say I teach this style, then yes, you have a duty to figure out what that style actually is.
Okay, pause for a second, Bob. Are you delineating between the history of the techniques and how they're done, or the actual history of who did what when? You know what I mean?
Those are intertwined, aren't they?
Are they?
Sure. Look, everybody interprets the techniques from their teacher, including the old guys back in the turn of the century.
I don't just interject there. I don't need the history of the automobile industry to learn.
No, you don't. But some people might, and you can't have somebody come in to your car dealership and you say, "I teach the old Ford style of manufacturing automobiles in the Model T fashion," and then just do whatever you want.
But nobody gives a shit about the history of the development of the car. All they care about is, does the car do what I want it to do?
No. I want a Model T.
No one makes those anymore.
Yes, but some people say, yes, we make Model Ts. And then you go into their shop and say, "Show me a Model T," and they give you a Honda Civic, and it's not right.
Okay. She says that so gently.
I was just going to say.
An autistic kid. It's like, Bob, no one makes them anymore.
Fuck you. Fuck you. God damn it. Okay, we have to pause for a second. Fucking hell. Fuck you, Mitch, for making a good point, and fuck you, Derek, for putting it out.
Okay,
but
Bob,
that's the point. Model T Fords are like Chitaru Karate. They're antiquated. Okay. And the point is, you shouldn't
wait a minute. What do you mean they're look, Model Ts are antiquated, obviously, but what do you mean? I don't understand how Chitaru is antiquated.
Do you think Sensei Dr. Chitose would come back from the past and look at what we're doing now and say that's his style?
Look, I don't want to get into evolution of styles because that's the next podcast.
But
topic.
You asked.
What I'm saying is, there's a delineation between how the techniques are done and the history of the techniques. And I'm wondering if you're mixing those up. Like, when I talk about history, I'm talking about who did this at what point in history and who passed it on to who and who brought it to Canada. That's what I mean by the history of a particular style. Sure. My perspective is I'm not interested in history. I never have been. What I care about is I want to do the techniques. I want to.
But we're not talking about you, dude. Darren, what about the history in BJJ?
Yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, I know, but it's there. It's there.
You don't need it. I don't know. I've never learned it in any place I trained at. Here's the moves.
Okay, we're not talking about individuals here. We're not talking about you individually or Mitch individually. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu lineages are important in that martial art, right?
Yes.
And you can't purport to be part of an important lineage of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu unless you know what it is and can tell anybody who wants to listen.
Wait, Bob, you're saying that like it's a universal truth. It's not.
No, I'm not. I'm not saying like it's a universal
truth. Well, hang on
a
sec. You said if you're training in this, then that, and this, and that.
I'm saying if that's the auspices under which you teach, then you have to be knowledgeable in them.
The question is, how important are the things? I think Bob's touching on there is a level of importance if you're purporting to teach a certain discipline and people do follow the lineage. So as opposed to how important are the things, well, it depends on what you're teaching and what you're purporting to teach, and that would be the level of importance. To most of us, we don't find it that important, but obviously other people do. So how important is it? Well, it depends on where you're training and what you're purporting to teach and what you're looking to learn as a student.
But we say we're teaching Chitaru Karate, and Lenny says he's teaching Kenpo. Lenny, how important is the lineage of your style to you?
It's not.
You've got to be kidding me.
I knew absolutely nothing of the lineage or history of Kenpo until I started my own club. I, 15 years with my own sensei, I knew nothing of the lineage of it, and I just went away eventually and studied, found out myself. And
now why? Why did you find out? Like
I was curious. I've always been curious about martial arts. I like to know lineage of, just purely from a fascination point of view, how something started in the East and headed is now global. You know, and you know, for me, it's grand when adults don't particularly give two hoots when they come in, but the kids like to know, why are we wearing a black uniform? Why is the crest got a tiger and a dragon on it? Why are we different to do the uniform? Everybody's wearing white uniforms. So it's nice to be able to tell that. It's nice to be able to tell them that.
Do you give no regard to the techniques of the style as they were passed down? Like, no. Are you completely free to interpret them completely as you want? Like, how restrained do you think you are to the style?
I hate to do this, guys. This is leaning heavily into another podcast topic.
I really
want to explore,
all right,
which is stylistic evolution.
And so, it's obviously going to be a good one.
I hope so, but I don't want to. I hate doing that because I don't want to inhibit the conversation. But
no, it's cool.
No, because I think this is one we really go into deeply when we do get into it.
Let's talk for just a second about the history of the individual style we're practicing.
But that's the only point I was parting to there, was the history of it, where it came from, who brought it here.
Right.
I'm not talking about how important it is that we practice the actual technical side of it correctly. Yeah, that's hugely important. But where it came from and who brought it here and why we wear a black suit, who cares?
Len, in the various syllabus relative to the ranks that you have at the club, is there any of the history of your style on those requirement sheets?
No, nothing.
And I applaud that. We have a lot of that on our requirement sheets to move from rank to rank. Not a lot. There's some. I'll say there's some. And I never understood it. We were never asked about it. It's irrelevant to me. I don't understand why it's there. So
my only point is, where do you get off teaching Chitoru if you don't know anything about it and you don't care about how specifically the techniques of that style are practiced?
Ah, different things though, Bob. I can know how the techniques are practiced without knowing who invented them and who passed them on to who.
No. Are you sure those are the way that they were meant to be taught? I don't know.
And nobody can.
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
Wait.
History wouldn't tell you if that's the exact.
Come on, different topic.
Bob. Okay, no. Look at our club specifically. Started with Chitose, and then Soroko was in there someplace.
There are videos
wait,
of
and
Chitose
then,
performing kata. Have you
well,
seen?
Okay, okay. Does that mean that if we watch that video, and wait, you're the one who brought it up.
Go ahead, yeah.
If we watch that video and compare how he does his techniques to the way we do them now, does that automatically mean we are not being true to the way the techniques are taught? I don't know. I'm asking you.
I think a lot of weight should be put on the way the guy who invented the style did the techniques.
But you invent the style, other people can perfect it from there. Like you've given them the tools.
But then you're not teaching the style, is my
Stop.
Point.
Sorry, guys, I'm putting the brakes on this. We're talking about that stylistic evolution again. So let's leave it.
I'll deal with you later.
Fuck you.
In closing on that one, can I just say there's a huge difference between history and application. History is just the story of facts of where it came from.
Yeah,
putting a can of worms again. Just don't do it. Yeah. Don't do it.
Next time.
Yeah. Okay, here's a question. Every single martial art that we have practiced originates from outside North America. How do you guys think shifting a martial art that was developed in one culture onto another culture impacts how that martial art is perceived? And let's take a particular thing I think we can all associate with, which is bowing. We bow in class Lenny. I assume you guys bow to each other. Yes. And to the instructors and all that stuff. I think I can say without fear of contradiction that how a bow is perceived in an Asian environment, let's talk about Japan, is completely different from how a bow is perceived in a North American perspective. And I think a lot of the martial arts falls into that category. It was developed in this environment and it was superimposed on this environment. And there's got to be some fallout from that.
I love bowing. I bow just in normal life to people I just first met. I think it's a great thing to do.
How do you perceive it, though, Bob? What does it mean when you bow to somebody?
It's a little bit of deference. It's a little bit of how do you do. It's an equal mix of both.
I think it's a nice, humble, respect thing.
In the Aikido dojo I went to, there's a banner that's like a banner with Japanese kanji written on it that's hung across the entrance to the dojo, and you have to duck under it in order to enter. And that was explained as a necessity to bow whenever you come in, and I thought that was charming.
I've had students, and especially female students, and not only one, say to me, I refuse to bow to anybody. I think it's insulting. I think it's reflective of a patriarchy. It's reflective of submissiveness and blah, blah, blah. I look back on those circumstances and I think, wow, this person really doesn't understand, and I don't mean to mark it as a denigration to those people, but they didn't understand the culture it came from because they're filtering it through their perspective of the culture in which they live.
There's an ego involved there, Mitch.
The thing is, I
understand their perspective, but I just don't agree with it.
When you're talking about a culture, all you have to do is apply it to your own culture. Like I remember in grappling, people stuck out your hand and you slapped each other's hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You shake the hand, you slapped it. That's the same as bowing.
Yeah, okay, but you're right, but that's far more easily transferable to a North American perspective. We high five, we fist bump, blah, blah, blah. So that hand slap thing, that's easier to make your peace with. Bowing is a different issue.
Both people bow. If one had to bow to the other while they
that's
didn't,
not true.
That's different.
Nope, that's not true.
Right.
When you walk into a dojo, the Q belts bow first. The black belts do not see a Q belt turn to them and bow.
Right.
The Q belts see the black belts and
but
turn
the,
to
the
them.
But the women don't
bow
first to the men.
No, but
I must be different because I'll bow simultaneously. Nobody bows first to me.
No, I'm sorry. How do you when you're standing there in class and or not in class, but before class starts and a student walks in and they see you. And maybe, Len, maybe this isn't applicable to your dojo.
Yeah,
but
maybe I've just adopted
the way we were taught was when you walk in, you turn and you bow to the head instructor. It doesn't matter if he sees you. It doesn't matter if he bows back to you. You bow to him, period.
That's interesting because I always greeted the higher belt before I bowed to them. That's just that's just a personal thing.
Like saluting an officer kind of thing you're delving into here, the militaristic
yeah.
side.
Yeah, I think like whenever I see somebody in a tournament or something like that, I'll just bow and then you stick out your hand and shake hands. But that's different than walking into a class and someone doesn't even see you and you're bowing. I disagree with that completely.
I do too, but that's how we were, or maybe I'm the only one. That's how I was weaned. So
yeah, same here.
I'm just saying that I think a lot of very successful clubs, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, for instance, like Darren said, they don't bow. They have that hand slap sort of thing before they do their thing. And I get that, and I like that. I don't think bowing is necessarily a bad thing. I think it's important that it is explained to the students in the context of why you bow and to whom you bow and under the circumstances under which you bow. I think all that's really important.
But it's exactly the same. Bowing and slapping hands is just a sign of respect to the person you're about to
fight. Exactly, that's what I'm saying. It's like whatever art or discipline or club you're in, whatever show of respect they do, that's what you adopt. It doesn't matter whether from North America or fucking anywhere else.
I don't disagree. I'm just saying that bowing is applied differently in different clubs, and I've seen it applied in ways that I don't think is necessarily reflective of a mutual respect. That's all I'm saying.
The other thing is, if you're told going up through the ranks that you must bow to the head instructor when you're coming in, when you're told you must bow, that takes away from the reason you're bowing to begin with. If you're being forced to do it, if you do it of your own accord, that's the sign of respect. If you're doing it because that's the doctrine of the place, there's no respect there. You're just doing
But a beginner has to be informed of what the etiquette is.
But they'd be informed of why it's that way, and hopefully they can adopt that and appreciate it.
For the first number of years that I was at the club, I bowed because I was afraid to get yelled at if I didn't. Now when I bow, whether I'm bowing into the dojo, whether I'm bowing to someone I'm going to work out with, or I'm bowing at the beginning or end of class, I take that quite seriously. And there's a thought process I go through every time I bow to somebody or to a symbol or to whatever I'm bowing to. But I don't think it's fair for that expectation to be placed on a beginner that, you have to understand that this is why you're bowing. It should be explained for sure. But I think a lot of beginners bow because it's what they're told to do, because they actually have any appreciation.
In a couple of sentences, that can be corrected.
It can be explained. I don't think it can be corrected. I think experience and a sense of humility and a sense of self needs to factor in before somebody really understands the reason for bowing. I think bowing is extremely important. And I think it's a very personal thing that each person does, but I I don't think it's given its full due by just a couple of sentences of explanation.
Here's a question: are there just to throw it out there? Are there any high level black belts you would not bow to? Of course not. You got to do that. You got to go through the motions.
Depends on the circumstance. Look, if we're at a tournament or we're in a class, of course I will bow to those anymore. Individuals. Oh, go ahead, Darren. That's way more interesting than what I was saying.
No, I was just saying I used to just bow to everybody just because that's what you're supposed to do. But nowadays, if I like the person, I'll bow to. If I don't like them, I just walk up, shake hands, or whatever. I don't give a shit.
Oh, but what about a class setting? If you're in a class with that individual.
Oh, yeah, Jesus.
Exactly. That's my point. Is
I have a related question there. Have you guys ever, I've done this multiple times over the years, let's say I was taking an aerobics class at a gym, and when I walk into the aerobics room, I bow because it's just been such a habit to bow before you go into the fucking dojo, and I realize, holy shit, I'm just in a gym, and you'll bow going into the room, and then realize, oh shit, that's not the setting.
Yeah, when I'm introduced to someone and expected only to shake their hands, I bow a little bit as I do so. It's just habit, and I like it.
I associate bowing with the martial arts. I would never consider bowing to somebody outside of a martial arts environment. It's just not the culture. There are a lot of people in the martial arts I don't particularly respect, but the only time I run into those people is in the context of the martial arts, at a tournament, in a class, whatever. And in those environments, yes, I will bow to them out of a sense of tradition and propriety, not out of a sense of how much I actually respect that individual. All right, guys, let's jump to another talking point. Anyone else want to pick one of the talking points that Ken put out, and we'll talk about that one?
Oh, geez. Let me read. Let's see.
Oh, boy. Quick, open up the talking points, Bob.
Oh, God. But considering the time, two of them could go for long.
Let's do the last one, because that's really juicy.
I was thinking that, but I was thinking that might go on for a while.
Right, and that's why we can do it now.
Okay, the culture between adults and children is pretty straightforward.
So let's jump to the last one then. How does gender play a role in this environment? Should there be men's only classes, women's only classes? How does gender play into the training? Okay, Bob, you go first, obviously.
Everybody's brain is a can of worms that's being opened right now.
Holy.
I'm an old man. And I'm a boomer. Am I a boomer? Yes, I am. Am I a proud boomer? Semi. There should not be men's only classes and women's only classes. Well, of course not, really. When I start thinking more deeply about it, of course not. Women are trying to train to defend themselves often against men. And men should not be training only with themselves and dismissing the ability of the women in the class. To me, let's start this off by saying that's ridiculous. Okay, go.
Lenny, nice. you've got a club that's a going concern. Yeah. Do you do gender-specific classes?
No, absolutely. Mainly for the reasons that Bob said. You don't know who's going to, if you're ever in a situation where you may have to defend yourself. You can't say, I'm not used to defending myself against a certain gender. I can only train with the other gender, so don't attack me, please.
Hey, you know? That brings up a point, Lenny, which is entirely, sorry to throw this okay. in, which is, it's entirely unrelated, but this the woke culture and the LGBTQ, how does that affect you personally with your club? Have people come in and declared their gender and been sort of ambivalent about their gender, etc.?
Not to date, really. I've maybe had a couple of cases with kids where parents were saying they'd rather be associated with a different gender, but only when it comes to competition.
Is there a...
And my only answer there is, look, at the way it is in competition, there's rules set by higher powers. At the moment, there's two genders. If you're born female, I'm sorry, you have to fight female. If you're born male, you have to fight male. And that's an actually have to grind with a higher power than me. And
that's the... that's very interesting because who knows.
But to date, no. But it's going to happen someday. It will rear its head.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
What about when you get, or if you were to get, a woman coming in, and I think it's fair to say we all have an eye toward practicality in how we train. and a woman comes in who has been involved in a situation where her safety has been put at issue by a man. So she says, I'm uncomfortable training with men. I want to learn to defend myself, but I'm uncomfortable at this
point. That's a great question.
With training with men. How do you deal with that? She's just not comfortable being in a room with men in any kind of workout setting. What would you say to someone like that? Sorry, Darren, what?
She's going to have to find an all-female club. That's pretty straightforward as well.
But Len, you run a club full-time. How would you react to a woman who came in and said that?
Yeah, really throw me a curveball. But I think I would try and approach it in a sensitive way and say, look, okay, I understand you're not comfortable with men. We have a huge portion of ladies training here. We have some lady instructors. Unfortunately, at the moment, we don't have solely ladies classes, but we can guarantee, outside of a warm-up, which is just a gang of people warming up in a room, we can guarantee that maybe we can ease you into this by working solely with the ladies in the room. We can approach it in a way that, you know, at the outset, to help you feel more comfortable, we can you'll work with the other ladies in the room and still get as equally as good a workout and as much attention to detail, and hopefully through that it might help you progress with your concerns. And that's all you can do is do your best.
I agree, and I agree with Bob in terms of what he originally said relative to this question. I think men's classes and women's classes are nonsensical. I don't look at gender when I'm in front of somebody, whether I should or not. I look at size, I look at ability, I look at strength. I've worked out with women who were measurably stronger than some guys I've worked out with. It's not a gender issue. It's about individual. And I've worked out with women who are markedly more capable and more skilled than I am. So when I train with somebody, gender couldn't mean less to me. And if I were running a club, I don't think I would feel comfortable having men's only and women's only classes. It to me just doesn't sit right. It doesn't make sense to me.
I think it's something that's manipulated here for marketing purity. People advertise women's only classes. It does happen here, not in my own session, but I've seen it where people I know will do a 10-week women's only kickboxing, and it's purely to market to get a female instructor and then paint it in a nice picture, and it's purely to make money.
It's like women's only fitness clubs.
I'm going to kind of take a different pose on this. I'm not sure that we should be commenting on a woman's perspective without a woman being here to chime in. I honestly am not sure that this is a question we can adequately address without having a woman on the panel to speak to this.
Here's a quick throwaway question, and it's not meant to be, you know, bandied about for very long. But if you had a person come in who said they were male and now they identify as female because they've had surgery, where do they get changed? And that's just a quick thing. It's not meant to be deep.
I don't have changing rooms in my place, so I don't have that problem.
Excuse me?
I don't have changing rooms. You arrive and you're geared, ready to train. Just the commercial premises I'm in, we don't have it.
Oh, they don't? Wow. They drive their cars in their uniforms?
Yeah.
Wow.
I can change the toilet. I've got a small storeroom if you really want to use it. It's a unisex storeroom. Go in there and change. Next person
a unisex eating. Storeroom.
Yeah.
We store all the genders in there.
There's every gender of strike shields.
Okay, guys, look, let's bring this one to a close.
Hey, can I ask one there? Just one very quick one.
Of course, yeah.
It was on the end of Kenneth's point there. It says, what are our thoughts on punishment for rule infractions? Mm. I mean, does anyone have that?
I'd be all about positive reinforcement as opposed to punishment. But if you do something...
But somebody punches
says
somebody
the man who got somebody frostbite in their feet.
Hang on, let Darren finish his point.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's more like if you're being a dick, then your positive reinforcement isn't going to work. So there has to be some sort of repercussion. But punishment's not the proper term, I don't think, for that. Like, and what's the rule? It depends on the rule, obviously. I don't like the term punishment, really. Like,
take the worst case scenario.
He'll be... Let's say...
Get your sparring gear on.
Yeah, something like that. Like it's not
sorry,
punishment.
That's a punishment.
No, it's...
discipline.
No. Let's not mince words. If someone's being a dick and you say, put your sparring gear on, I'm going to show you what's what, that's a punishment.
Okay. No, it's not.
Sure it is.
No.
What is it then?
You're not punishing the guy.
It's just going to beat the shit out
of him.
You
said take your sparring gear off.
No, I didn't say I was going to beat the shit out of him either. You're kind of just bringing him back down to whatever level he's at.
You're humbling.
Yeah, but that's not punishment. That's kind of reinforcing.
I don't know, man.
This.
That's splitting hairs.
Like, it's not.
I'm explaining the rules to you. No.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying. You don't go in and just take his head off and go, there you go. That's what you get for hitting that other person. No, you're going in. You're going a little bit harder than he does. You're putting him in his place. You're not causing any damage. You're just explaining, look, don't go around doing this to other people. Like, just, you know.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't think you're thinking about the worst case scenario. What if somebody kicks a kid in the head?
No, then you sit down and you go, you ever do that again, you're out of the club. And there's a whole big explanation. You're not going to go in and punish them. Like, we're adults, man. I'm not getting punishment for nothing. If I accidentally kick someone in the head and I get chastised for it, so be it. No one's punishing
me. I mean on purpose.
Then you're out of the club. Fuck that. No punishment. You're just out.
Okay, let's pull back a bit from the worst case scenario. You've got a rule at the club that a student breaks. You have to bow before you come in. A student just walks onto the floor without bowing. There's an infraction of the rules.
Trying to get him to just stand in one position is a task nowadays.
So, look, in broad terms, let me ask the question. Does punishment for rule infraction have a place in modern-day martial arts environments?
I think a lot of this can go into what age we're dealing with. Obviously, if a kid's acting up, you give them a little bit of a time and say, listen, take a break there. But if it's an adult, a grown man or a grown woman, who's got a very different approach.
Does punishment have a place in a current martial arts environment? And let's not dance around it. It's a yes or a no.
No.
Len.
I think so.
That's Bob.
I don't know if I go down the route of punishment, but definitely some kind of explanation of discipline and.
Now, explaining something to somebody is not a punishment.
Right.
So
that's his point.
So, and that's fine.
That's my point.
So you're saying no.
You need to clarify ground rules as opposed to punishing them.
Okay.
If that doesn't work, where are you then? Like, people can be assholes, and if they continue to be assholes, you got to do something.
Tumbleweeds.
No, we're all thinking.
No, I'm trying to figure out how to reply to it. Like, he's right.
The thing is,
punishment is the way to do it.
I'm going to come out and say I don't think that punishment is a bad thing at all. Depending on the circumstance. Like, of course you try to take a softer approach to make somebody understand what the rules are and the requirements of your presence in the club and blah, blah, blah. But Bob's also right. There are some people who are assholes. Now, should you, and I've been the subject of being punished a number of times, and I can't help but look back on those circumstances and go, you know what? You're right. I was an asshole. And I'm glad I was punished because the only other option is to have kicked me out of the club. And that wouldn't have done me any good. That wouldn't have solved the problem. It probably would have killed my interest in the martial arts, which for me as a person would have been tragic. So I'm glad that I was punished. I can't help but think in certain circumstances that punishment is the best thing.
What about those times where you say if you make a mistake, everybody has to do 25 push-ups? Is that punishment?
It's hilarious.
I was just going to say that. I used to think that was hilarious. I just did the push-ups.
I know. There was a circumstance, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, where we're running a class and we had a blue belt. It was a woman blue belt. And she was asked what the Japanese terminology for a certain technique was. And it was a technique she should have absolutely known, but she didn't know. So it was, okay, everybody down and start doing push-ups, and we're going to do push-ups until you come up with the right answer. And, man, she was out looking through requirement sheets and trying to find the answer and blah, blah, blah. I thought that was hilarious and appropriate and not outrageous. I think it served the purpose quite well.
Did she find the answer?
Yes, she did. Because the requirement sheets were right there. Even if she didn't know it, she leafed through them and she found the right answer and it was fine. I don't think we did more than 30 or 40 or 50 push-ups. I can't remember. But the point was, it was a circumstance that was intended to be a little ironic and a little funny. And it was perceived that way. Anyway, that was my perception of that. I don't think punishment is a bad thing in certain circumstances. And I think for myself, if I had not been punished, I probably wouldn't be in the martial arts now. So I can't help but look at it in a certain context as a good thing.
I'm reminded of every military movie ever made and scenes about punishment when one person doesn't do what they're supposed to do and how appropriate that is in this context. And that's fodder for another podcast episode. But yeah, I just threw that in.
Okay, guys, let's bring this one to a close. Let's go around the table once, and any comments you want to make about this particular podcast, broad terms, specific, I don't care. Bob, anything to say?
Man, as usual, we dove into stuff, and it was, what's the word for stuff that comes out of it? It was productive. Productive. I think it was very productive, and we each get to know each other a little bit better through these conversations, good conversations, and I had a great time. That's all.
I kind of echo what Bob was saying, but like in some circumstances, you have something that you have your own views going in, and then the views are changed. I think despite the talking points around this one, I haven't really changed my views. I don't know whether I just have to be stronger in these particular views that I can't be swayed, or the arguments that ensued weren't enough to convince me. But usually going in, I go back with food for thought. It's like, Jesus, maybe I need to rethink this. And just in this particular talking points tonight, I'm not really changing my opinion on anything.
I think you were very strong.
Yeah, maybe it's just what the... No, here, I might wake up tomorrow, have a completely different opinion. So I think, yeah, just what Bob said, like as usual, you just end up having a good time and it's a different way of thinking. And I like everybody's points, whether I agree with them or not, or sometimes not relevant. It's just you listen to what it is and you take it in and you accept it. You can still argue your point, but you're still here in a different sense, which either makes you rethink your point or at least forces you to be able to articulate your point. So you can't just walk in and go, this is how it is. But when you hear somebody else's opinion, you're forced to justify your opinion on a much more articulate level than just saying, this is what I think.
I like the fact that Lenny comes from a different style, so he brings a good perspective on this whole thing.
Yeah.
I would say this is weird. I think this is one of the few podcasts where we've all been entrenched in our opinions and we've all stuck nearly hardline to some of them. But what it did do was it opened up the rabbit hole of, particularly we started getting into evolution styles and that. It was really getting to the stage where, hold on a second, I don't believe this and you believe this. And I just do think that the follow-up on that conversation is going to be brilliant. And kudos for that. As always, it just sparks more thought and you look forward to the next one. And as Bob said, we get to know each other a bit more, particularly on where our principles lie and so on. So it's good.
The next podcast topic is definitely going to be about stylistic evolution, because I think there's a ton of conversation there. I'm slowly coming around. Look, I've gone on a number of times about why I started the podcast and blah, 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 blah. My reasons for continuing the podcast are much different than the reasons that I had for starting it. I love what Bob said, is that we get to know each other a little bit better. I got to tell you.
There it is. There it is.
Well, I was waiting for Bob to say it, but it took him too long. You were about to, though.
Look, the reason I carry on with these podcasts is markedly different than why I started them. And one of the reasons is I'm finding out a little bit more about how you guys think and about how I think, leveraging off what you guys think. Like, I think that's the greatest advantage to me of these podcasts is it makes me go, am I really thinking about this the right way? And that doesn't come across because I know I've got a very strong personality. I'm an asshole. And I don't think I often bend on my perspective when we're having the podcast. But, oh, my God, my perspective shift day to day and moment to moment when I think about them and then when I re-listen to them, which I do quite often. So
I hope that both of your listeners really...
you're an asshole. What a dick.
Take that into account and concur.
Okay, folks, we're going to bring this one to a close. Thanks again to Bob, Lenny, and Darren. And special thanks to Ken Whitman for sending in those talking points. Really, really appreciate it. As always, send your comments to my personal Facebook page, the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, or an email at nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. And again, if anyone wants to come on the podcast and join in the madness, please let me know. We'd love to have you. Thanks so much, guys. Okay, we're done. We're out.